Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Wow, buddy! You look healthy and happy.
Veterinary surgeon and natural pet food pioneer John Burns knows the positive impact a natural diet has on our beloved pets. That's why he developed Burns Pet Nutrition.
Maybe I should try some of your pet food myself. Okay. I'll start with a salad.
For natural, no nasty, wholesome recipes, choose Burns Pet Nutrition. Available from veterinary clinics and all good pet shops across Ireland.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, join us in Killarney's INEC on Saturday the 13th of April.
Tickets for Belfast show have sold out on Ticketmaster.ie, but limited availability remains at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
I don't like eating orders very well, and he also was said to be responsible for a number of events that were unsanctioned and that he was using IRA weapons to do things off his own back. He was just someone who didn't like to be sitting around the house not doing anything. He wanted to be in the middle of the action. He wanted to be out there. The way it was said to me by one sort of veteran Republican was, there was a decision taken, if you go for him, you better put him down first time, because if not, he's going to come back. He's going to get you, you'll get your family. He never stopped.
I'm Nicola Tallant. And you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
He was a rogue Republican who was thrown out of the IRA, had a brief dalliance with the INLA and someone who lurched around other dissident groupings as an enforcer and a feared hitman, known for a love of violence but who couldn't be managed or controlled. This week, as killer and terrorist Gerard Hooker Moyna was laid to rest in Belfast, I'm talking with crime correspondent Alison Morris about the life and crimes of a troubled psychopath and about her brief encounter with him. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. So shots fired over his funeral at the graveyard was obviously making the headlines, but we're going to go a little bit deeper into who exactly was Gerard Hooker Moyna, a bit of his background. And you had done a kind of a deep dive and a long read into him when another news story that we covered sort of took over, which was obviously the Donaldson stuff. We're not going to talk about that this week, but give us a little bit of background on Moyna and also maybe what the Hooker is coming from.
So the shots were actually fired the night before his funeral. They put the coffin in the street where he came from.
Right.
Hooker Moyna, or Gerard Hooker Moyna as you call him, comes from a very famous street in Belfast called Bombay Street. If you were inclined to come here and take one of those taxi tours, it's one of the first places they'll take you to, because it's basically where the modern troubles, if you like, started. There was a loyalist attack at that interface. A lot of people's houses were burned. They had to move out. They became sort of refugees, if you like, and had to live other places. Local people rebuilt Bombay Street. The people moved back. And Hooker Moyna was born and bred, as they say, and died in a house in Bombay Street.
Bombay Street?
So, Bombay Street.
So where's that name coming from?
It's in the Clonard. All of those streets around there are named after, you get like Sevastopol Street, and all those streets are named after like old British Army battles.
Okay.
It's bizarre, you know, and so he was born and bred there. Born, I suppose, if you like, is, you know, into the conflict, but was, he was one of those people who, you know, if you ask me, some people I meet or have interviewed or written about, And I say they would never have been involved in conflict whatsoever if there hadn't been troubles here and if there hadn't been a war here, whatever you want to call it. And other people probably, I think, were quite adapted and suited to that way of life. And he seems to be one of those people who thrived, if you know what I mean, in the chaos that was the conflict that existed around the Lower Falls at that time. He was a member of what they called was C Company of the Provisional IRA and a very active member of that part of the IRA. So much so, I suppose, that some of the big killings that he was synonymous with was the murder of Lenny Murphy, the Schenkel butchers who operated in the late 70s, early 80s, responsible for over 20 very, very vicious murders. They were a gang of loyalists who basically travelled around in a sort of black cab and black taxi, and they went through nationalist areas, pulled in any Catholic and took them away and tortured them with knives and other implements and then left their dead bodies and entries. He, Lenny Murphy, was the leader of the Schenkel Butchers, and Tucker Moyna was believed to have been responsible, one of the people who shot him dead.
So what year was that?
That was 82.
And what age would Moyna have been then?
Well, he was 69 when he died, so someone quicker than me could do the mental arithmetic on that.
But I'll do it on my I'll do it on the calculator.
Yeah.
Minus 1982. That's 42 years ago, right? So 42 years ago, and he was 69 when he died. 69 minus 42 equals 27. That was really quick, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But then if you take, I suppose, if you take 82 away and take it right back to 69, he was even younger then. He had only been a teenager then. And a lot of people from that time, they became involved or pulled in. Remember, internment and everything came quite afterwards. A lot of young people, especially young men, became involved in other loyalist or Republican paramilitary groups. We must say that many did not, but many did. And he is of that generation. So he became quite, I suppose, well known in term in Republican circles as someone who was prepared to be what they call, I suppose, what we'd call now in terms of hitman. Mm-hmm. But he was the kind of person who did with those up close and personal shootings. You know, he could walk up to someone and shoot them, and not everybody is cut out for that line of work. Let's face it, you know, hitmen are few and far between. He is also linked to the murder of solicitor and unionist politician Edgar Graham, who was shot outside Queen's University by the IRA in 1983. And he was involved in numerous IRA operations, but was considered a bit of a renegade and slightly out of control. And in the end, the IRA expelled him.
So basically, why would they do that? Because, like, obviously somebody who was prepared to do that kind of a hit would be useful for them during those times of conflict. But is this somebody who wasn't able to operate under the structured army that it was, like, where you had to kind of take orders and behave?
He had a number of arguments with very senior IRA men in positions of leadership, which would have been telling them things to do that he didn't want to do. I don't think he took orders very well. And he also was said to be responsible for a number of events that were unsanctioned, and that he was using IRA weapons to do things off his own bat, not for personal financial gain. There's never any suggestion of that. But he was just someone who didn't like to be sitting around the house not doing anything. He wanted to be in the middle of the action. He wanted to be out there. And he was involved in IRA activities that he was not meant to be involved in. But what I find interesting, especially when I was researching him, is there's many people like that, and you'll find them if you look through Lost Lives, which is that big, massive book that has all the deaths of people who died here during the conflict. And a lot of times they would have been court-martialed by the IRA and they would have been shot dead, or they would have been expelled from the country, or, you know, or they would have been subject to a punishment style shooting or an ECAPing.
Yeah.
That never happened in this case, which would tell you that he may have had enemies within the leadership of the IRA. He also clearly had some friends. And what I was also told was that there was a decision taken that, given his high profile and his standing within Clonard, that it might cause, you know, ructions among that section of Republicanism if they took action against him in any other way. But also because basically he was considered so mental that they would say, you know, what the way it was said to me by one sort of veteran Republican was, there was a decision taken, if you go for him, you better put him down.
Yeah.
The first time, because if not, he's going to come back. He's going to get you, he'll get your family. He never stopped, basically, until he is. So there was a decision at that stage to let him jog on, thinking that he would just fade away to obscurity, and instead he didn't. And I spoke to people who knew him very well, and they said he couldn't cope, especially in the 90s. There was already talk of the Provisional IRA starting to wind down. They were involved in peace talks, the Hume Adams talks were ongoing, and I think that he could see the direction of travel, and he didn't want anything to do with that. He wanted to be in the thick of it. He thrived on the adrenaline, I suppose, of that type of lifestyle. And he had a sort of brief flirtation with the NLA, which would be that sort of Marxist Republican group. They had been subject to a split following the Supergrass trials of the 80s. And there was another even smaller splinter group, the Irish People's Liberation Army, the IPLO, and he joined them. And that would have been, for the IPLO, that would have been a big catch, because the IPLO was considered this sort of ragtag bunch of mainly people who had been thrown out or expelled or had left other organisations. They weren't particularly seen like, you know, big operators. A lot of them were heavily involved in drugs at that point in time. And remember, in the early 90s, when the drugs first started coming into Belfast, and this would have been more ecstasy, it wouldn't be cocaine at this time. This was the start of that, really, the rave culture. Those drugs came through loyalist drugs channels. And so for the IPLO to be involved in the dealing of those kind of drugs, they had to be in contact with loyalists. And this was very well known and clearly wasn't going down well. But I suppose that the final straw in terms of their future came whenever they were linked to the gang rape of a young woman in the Divis area of West Belfast. And after that, they were sent word that they were to disband. They refused and they said they were going to keep on going. And they...
And tell us about that gang rape. Was Moina himself seen as being involved in that?
No, this was young people, young members of the IPLO in the Divis area. And, you know, at the time it was, I mean, I'm from West Belfast. It was the talk of the place. You couldn't have done to a shop or a hairdresser's or a, you know, supermarket without people saying, had you heard what happened? A lot of the stories around it were exaggerated and some I don't think were horrific enough in terms of that. But some members of it had been involved and they were at a party. They were at some sort of all-night party. And a young woman ended up getting raped and killed for quite some considerable time and unable to get away from them. That sort of put the nail in the coffin. But up until that...
Was she the woman that had been... Was she the woman that had been out in a club and she was from a different part of Antrim, didn't know
No, that was one of those... Well, we should maybe do a podcast on that one day when that was one of those sort of Antal type killings. But no, this woman's never been named. You know, okay. She's never done any interviews or came forward. There was a lot going on, but there was also a feud and he was heavily involved in the internal feud that was going on within the IPLO. And in fact, he had been remanded because he was caught in a car, I think, with weapons in it somewhere in the Balmore area of North Belfast. And that was going to kill another member of the organisation as part of the feud that he was involved in. He was also then in 1992 linked to the murder of Jimmy Brown. Jimmy Brown was someone who was like a spokesperson for the IPLO. And he would have dealt a lot with the media at that time and dealt with the press and delivered their press statements. You know, and I know that there are probably a younger generation listening to this going, what are the media taking press statements off some mad group? But they were the times that we lived in and that was just what was going on at that time. And he would have been the press spokesperson. He would have been a very unlikely member of that organisation because they were, you know, they were basically, you know, a majority of them would have been pretty much gangsters and he was quite well-spoken, well-educated. He had took himself off to Dublin during the feud, basically for his own safety. But they got a call saying, look, we need to sort this out. We should have peace talks. And he drove to Belfast to take part in those peace talks. And as he drove into the Clonard area, he got out of his car to speak to Hucker Moina. And Hucker Moina shot him 10 times in broad daylight in front of numerous people. But obviously, given the times that they were, none of those witnesses came forward. He was never convicted of that. And Jimmy Brown was shot, I think it was like 4 times in the head and 6 times in the body and died almost instantly in the street. So there was a lot going on in terms of what was happening within the IPLO. Hucker finds himself in remand. And then probably one of the most interesting and least reported times of our conflict came around is in that the Provisional IRA decided we're going to move on these boys and disband this organisation by force. Mm. And that was when we had what became known as the Night of the Long Knives.
That's an extraordinary story. So to recap, just before we get to this Night of the Long Knives, he spent the 1980s as a man in his sort of coming to his late 20s, early 30s in the IRA, you know, taking some orders and going on certain operations, but also maybe jumping into others where he was not told to go or doing independent jobs that weren't sanctioned. He sort of became a little bit too crazy for them, so he's put out. He had a brief stint in the INLA, who possibly also thought he was a bit crazy. We're coming up into the 1990s at this point when he's in his mid-30s, I think, from my really bad mathematics, but he's coming to his mid-30s and probably towards his 40s. thrown out of the IRA and thrown out of the INLA is not good so far. He then ends up in this IPLO, which is an even sort of a more fractious movement where he double crosses and kills the PR guy, lures him to Belfast, kills him on the street.
In the street in front of everybody. And he's, you know, at this stage, I think, he was considered, some might say fearless, some might say ferocious, some might say, you know, completely not very psychopathic. He was also involved in those, what they would call those spray jobs in bars. He was involved in at least two killings where he went into a bar that would have been in a loyalist area and basically just shot anyone who was in, you know, opened up and shot and injured anyone who was in the bar. They were just purely sectarian killings. And all of this was leading up to the IPLO having a specific reputation of being, you know, this sort of sectarian gang who obviously were also cover for a lot of criminality. And remember, if you were a member of an organisation at that time, you had the protection of that organisation. So another organisation couldn't necessarily target you because that would have resulted in a bloody feud. So they had a sort of no strike first, albeit serious feuds did happen at that time. So Hooker, I was told, needed access to weapons. Because that was just who he was.
Well, he was a hitman.
So he needed to be in an organisation. He also needed access to mayhem because he thrived on that world and he wanted to be in the thick of it. And at the time, the IPLO were doing all sorts of mad, as I said, attacks on bars and all sorts of things. He wanted to be in the middle of that. And he also then had made quite a few enemies along his way and so needed the protection of an organisation. But, you know, the IPLO in itself may not have been the best venue for that. But then we have what became known as the Light of the Long Knives, which was so rarely reported. And Hooker Moyna himself wasn't really reported on or spoke about because people were too terrified to speak about him. Because even though he was quite an old man and quite ill, coming to the end of his life, he would have been the greatest of health, even though he's only 69, which is particularly old. He was still a fearsome person, which I will give evidence by a very personal story that I have. So Hooker's sons became involved in criminality. They'd broken into a house and carried out one of those sort of creeper-style burglaries to steal a car, but it attacked a man, the householder with a hammer, and they'd been jailed. And then a terrible tragedy, something completely unrelated, happened in the family. And so one of them was, they were released on compassionate parole to attend a funeral. One of them went AWOL from jail. And there was a whole big, massive police operation trying to find this guy. And there was, you know, all sorts of chases and all sorts of other things going on. And I'm reporting on this as a crime reporter on this guy in isolation from everything else that's going on. So I go out for my lunch one day and I'm happy as Larry when I come back. The receptionist looked a very pale shade of white. And she said, Hooker Moyna was in here looking for you.
Right.
And I went, oh. And she's, and he said he'll be back. So I obviously knew who Hooker Moyna was by reputation. And so I phoned one of my contacts. He would have been from that sort of Clonard, Lower Falls area and said to them, I actually remember my exact words were, Hooker Moyna has been in the office looking at me. Is that bad? And he said, oh, that's never good. We need to get that sorted out. And so I did try and ring around a few people and did get it sorted out, but Hooker's actually never did come back looking for me. So I think I managed to survive the rap.
Did he not like the way you'd reported about his sons?
I'm assuming he was in to argue with me about the reporting of his sons. I don't know in what way he planned to do that, whether that was over a cup of tea in a civilized conversation or whether that was in some other manner more akin to Hooker's past. But he didn't take too kindly to it anyway.
Right.
So you're lucky that, I mean, I am sitting here. I live to tell the tale of this. And I think he scared the receptionist more than he scared me. But I remember saying to several people at the time, everyone said to just shook their head and went, oh, no, that's not good.
Yeah, ferocious character, obviously, and unpredictable.
Yeah, so the we'll go back, I suppose, this night, October 31st, 1992, around 60 or 70 IRA men are involved in this Night of the Long Knives. And, you know, I have never really reported any in-depth on it until after the death of Hooker Moyna. And then I rang around people from around that time and I've just become obsessed, I suppose, with it in terms of that this happened and was allowed to happen and happened. And it just went, you know, basically so, was so little reported on it in modern times. So the IRA went, we're just going to go and wipe them out in one night. And that was it. So they went into a a GAA club in the Short Strand area of East Belfast. They singled out a guy called Sammy Ward, who was one of the IPLO leaders. This place is packed. October 31st, Halloween night, place is humping and buzzing. And they shot him 10 times, four times in the head. This was actually one of the gunmen in that killing was a guy called Kevin McGuigan, who would go on to also fall out with the IRA, who was linked to the murder of Jack Davison in 2015, and then who himself was murdered as a reprisal for that.
Right.
But they left another IPLO man who was with him, and he was also lying on the floor, and he was purposely left. I was told just in this last week, he was purposely left to go back and send back word, this is what's happening, we would need to sort this out. So as well as that shooting on that night, there were a number of people who were also kneecap given punishment style shooting, so shot in the legs, the knees. And then there was others who were told to take themselves off out of the country. But the IPLO, because of the lifestyle that they were living, and I mean, most of them were either involved, some of them were involved in drugs and criminality, but obviously they were also involved in internal feuds. So they were all living in heavily fortified houses. And I don't mean big mansions. I mean, you know, council houses, but with huge steel doors, or what used to happen in houses then, in these sort of wee houses that existed down in the Lower Falls in West Belfast at the time, is you'd have had houses where you walked in through the front door and the stairs were directly in front of you. And there would have been these cages built around the stairs. The first house I ever bought had one of these cages built around the stairs because of the person who lived in it before me. And I mean, they weren't a cage and like a prison cage. They were done by, you know, metal workers who used to put like big harps and Celtic, you know, symbols and try and make these things look fancy, even though you bolted them and padlocked the gate at night.
You'd put your little Christmas lights around it nowadays, wouldn't you?
If there was a fire, you were all dying. Yeah. There was nobody was escaping any of these houses. If there was, it not only saved you from getting anyone coming in to kill you, but it saved you getting back out again. I remember when, you know, one of my now oldest child going, why is that there? And I just was struggling to come up with some explanations to why we had a cage. Anyway, we took ours out. Probably should have left it.
I was going to say, you might have been better off to leave it. Yeah, if you have Hermione coming to see you.
Given the time that it was and what was happening in that area, probably should have left it. But the IPLO had all of these cages and these huge steel doors. And in the run-up to the planning of this letting of the long knives, this was clearly discussed among the IRA men responsible who were going out to target them. And they were like, well, you can't put their doors in. You know, you can't kick them in. You can't put them in with the baton. These things are built not to go in. And one of them then says, well, we can't take them in. We'll take them out. And so that's what they did. They had angle grinders and grinded right round, took the whole door right off the frame. In some cases, they blasted the doors right out of the walls, took half the wall of the house out with it. In other cases, they, you know, attached crowbars and things to it and then pulled these doors, literally pulled the doors off the hinges. A number fled, left the country. Hooker survived this. You know, would he have survived it? Because who would have wanted to be the crew that was sent to Hooker's house? Well, you know, maybe they'd have had to just send twice as many people, but he was in criminal prison on remand at the time for another event. So I'm told that the guy who survived the GAA shooting 2 days later shows up at the Crumlin Road prison to visit Tucker Morna and says to him, what are we going to do? You know, we need your advice. And I am told that more or less his exact words were, give them every last gun, every last bullet, you know, and beg for your life and hope that they let you live. And that was his advice to them. And within a week, they had, as I said, packed up their tent and left. They put out a statement saying that they were disbanding, there would be no more. And that was the end of that. So that was how the IPLO came to an end as a result of the night of the long knives.
So was Moyna a sort of almost an enforcer for the IPLO? He wasn't obviously one of the leaders.
He was just a terrifying figure. Yeah, he was the guy who was running around doing a lot of the shootings because, you know, they were mainly very young men and he was running around doing a lot of those killings. He was also then someone who they would have went to advice. But remember, the IRA came to target them. Nobody knew the IRA better than Hooker Moyna. So it made sense that they came to ask him for advice on what to do. And his advice was, you know, pack it up and call it a day, boys. That's it. It's over, yeah.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the end of him. Because he then went on
no, because to the IRA. Would they not have... So this part of history hasn't been written about much until now, the night of the long knives. But clearly he would have been, you'd imagine, one of the most high profile members of that IPLO. And would he not have, would the IRA not have sat back and waited for him to come out of prison and then go for him? Was it just this operation was only happening once one night, or?
It was going to happen once. It was going to happen one night. And I think that they believe that Hooker being offside and Crumlin Road and these people being weakened by that, if you'd have walked up his path to shoot him, he was shooting back at you. You know, he wasn't just taking this, land down in some respects. So
that was the time to go when he was in jail.
Safer to keep him offside and do it while he wasn't there. Mm. And if he was there, because of given the fact that he had such a fierce reputation, if you have 60 IRA men out to take the entire IPLO right across north, and some of them are situated North Belfast, some in West Belfast, if you're going to take them out in one night, you're sending, you know, maybe four or five people to each house. You know, the way it was described to me is you'd have probably had to send all 60 to Hooker's house just to make sure you were taking them down. And so it made more sense to do it while he was in jail, and that's what happened.
So would he have also, would that have been a kind of a clever decision of his to advise them to disband, you know, to hand over the thing? It would have been part of his survival instinct?
He knew the IRA inside out. He had been a member of them. He was a very young man. He knew that they had superior numbers, firepower, and that if they were determined to take kill every single one of them in the way they had Sammy Ward, that they would. And so, you know, it was to him, it was a strategic decision. It was, you know, if I'm going to get out of prison here, I need to make sure that when I get out, that this isn't still ongoing. So I would say it was strategic on his part. But then again, you know, he seemed unable to come out and live what would be considered a quiet life. A lot of people, they do, you know, things like this, and they're very, they might be very violent and active in their youth. And then, you know, age mellows us all. You know, we do. I mean, we're all much, much different people than we were when we were younger. And a lot of people then come out and say, well, no, I'm going to start looking at a political path if I still remain that way inclined. Or I'm just going to give this up altogether and just go and live a quiet life with my children, my grandchildren and everything else. But, you know, he was described to me by people who knew him much better than I did, because obviously my meeting with him was thankfully cut short because I was on my lunch at the time.
Saved by Sambo.
He needed the adrenaline of it. He needed the constant, and he wasn't in favour of the ceasefires at that time. He didn't want the IRA to wind up. He didn't want the war to end, because it was all he knew. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he lived off that. And it's interesting because I spoke to someone who'd been in prison around that time and got out, and they said, you know, they get out of prison to peace. People didn't know what to do with themselves. People who had only ever been in the IRA, they'd only ever been in these organisations, they'd only ever been involved in conflict. They were standing around with their hands in their pockets going, what do we do now? Mm-hmm. You know, and some very quickly went into community work, development work. Some very quickly went into politics and went into electioneering or became members of Sinn Féin. Some went, you know, completely and went and lived very quiet, but probably quite productive lives. But others, you know, and there's a handful who just held up a bar, got drunk and talked about the olden days, and you remember this, and you remember that, and they were so stuck in that time that they couldn't move on.
So Moina got out of prison sort of sometime in the mid-90s. He's hitting 40 at this stage. Peace is coming to Northern Ireland. Certainly the IRA are moving towards that. He goes to the Continuity IRA.
Does the Continuity IRA are interesting. They were probably one of the oldest dissident groups. Remember, they're formed from that sort of Rory O'Brada split when, you know, Sinn Féin voted that they were going to take their seats in the Dáil, and he walked out in protest. And the Continuity IRA was linked to that Republican Sinn Féin faction. They would be more older, traditional. It's interesting because clearly none of this for Moina was about the politics, because the IRA, when he would have been a member of it, would have been quite a sort of, the leadership of it would have been quite a Catholic organisation. It would have been, you know, very socially constrained. It had very, and then the provisional IRA were made up of younger men who were clearly much more radical than would have been in the official IRA. But the INLA and the IPLO were Marxists, you know, who were, you know, they're Marxists, and they had a completely different political outlook than what would have been that. So for Moina, clearly it was never about the politics. So to go from, you know, that Marxist INLA IPLO faction to go back to the Continuity IRA, who, you know, Rory O'Brada was of, you know, the most socially conservative. These are men who took part in the IRA's 50s campaign. You know, they were people who were altar huggers. You know, they were never at a church the juxtaposition of their lives as members of, you know, an organisation, and also then of their faith and the fact that they were very socially conservative, I suppose, in a way. Remember that sort of devil era type of Ireland, you know, the reflections of that. I could go off on a tangent and tell you a story about Rory O'Brada, but I wonder should I stick to this. It's a good one though.
So when tell us.
when he retired as leader of Republican Sinn Féin, he'd been president of Republican Sinn Féin since the split for years. And when he was retiring, I went down to interview him. He lived in Roscommon in this lovely little cottage, you know, and had naga and everything, very traditional, walls lumber books, you know, no trappings of wealth or anything. And this man sat speaking to me for a good hour and a half, 2 hours. And it was like being in a history lesson, but a living history lesson, because he was talking about things that I had read in history books, but they were part of his lived experience. Very interesting man, very intelligent man. He spoke about what he's seen as the betrayal of Gerry Adams and the split and everything that happened and all. And I'm writing all this, I'm going to write all this in a feature and listening intently. And the photographer's taking pictures the whole time, and his wife brought us out lovely tea, and, you know, it was that very country welcome, you know, baked scones and everything. So the photographer gets up to go, we get up to go, and he turns around to the photographer and he says, "Can you wait outside? I want to have a word with Alison on her own." And when the photographer walked outside, he said, "I have a new code word for you. The army want to speak to you." And he gave me a new code word for the continuity IRA. And I remember at the time thinking, when he dies, I'm seriously going to write about this story, because the British government in the 1970s called Rory O'Brada the gentleman terrorist, because he looked like a history teacher. You know, he had always a tweed coat with a, you know, suede patches on the arms and the shirt, the tie and the waistcoat. And at this point, he was a very, very old man. And I thought, my God, he really was a gentleman terrorist right up until the day he died. Anyway, we went off on a tangent. That was the continuity IRA.
Did I tell you that I thought he lived down in Dublin for a do you remember we had this conversation?
I think he pretty did, but he lived in Roscommon at this point in time. I thought it was a quick drive to Belfast, Roscommon.
I think he lived near me, and I think I was friendly with... Did he have a daughter?
I am really not sure.
I can't remember.
But he did live in... He lived in a beautiful wee house in Roscommon, him and the wife.
Yeah.
So that was... Anyway, he joined the Continuity IRA, who would have been of that, but a completely different set of politics. So clearly, when hookers jump on from one group to another, it's not because he believes in their political ideology, their outlook. He just likes the madness of that. You know, he likes just being involved.
Was there an element of who'd take him as well? You know, he's already been to the INLA.
Knowing that most of these groups and the fact that the numbers of them were so dwindling at that time, someone like Hooker Moyna, who, you know, was a hitman basically, he had, you know, while we could question his motivation, you can question his behaviour, you can look at all of the people and the chaos and the mayhem, the grief he caused by the number of people that he was involved in murdering over the years, you know, and people like Edgar Graham, you know, professional man, a solicitor, a unionist politician, you know, killed by leaving the university, all of that. And you can question all of that from a paramilitary group point of view. This guy's an asset. You know, any of them are going to take him in, because he had maybe what he lacked in political thinking, and he had no interest in the political side of it. What was said to me was he didn't lack balls, you know. This is someone who you could have said and he would go out and do this, that and the other. How mad does that make you? I don't know. But yeah, so I think that they would have jumped at the chance to getting him into the organisation.
So what does he do then throughout the noughties and, you know, times?
He was linked to a failed bomb attempt. The Continuity IRA had attempted to plant a bomb in the town, and the detonators exploded, but the bomb didn't. And he was said to have lost a couple of fingers and injured his eye in that attack. And then after that, you don't hear very much from him, apart from the time he came looking at me. He hangs around in those... He lives in his street where his mother and father had been brought up, and he stays there right until the time he dies. He has children and grandchildren. And then, obviously, he died and all of this came back up. I mean, I had forgot he existed because I hadn't heard from him in years. And then we go back through all of this. And then, obviously, during this week, a video emerges on social media which shows three masked men. The coffin is in the middle of Bombay Street, you know, the street where he had lived. The tricolour over the top of it. There's a huge big picture of him beside it. You can go onto the Belltel website and watch this video if you're interested. And they come out and fire three shots over the coffin, which would have been something that would have happened a lot in the past, but doesn't particularly happen now. Now, interestingly, what group was responsible for that? I'm not particularly sure, to be honest.
Yeah, or were they just old friends?
Hooker Moyna had between that many organisations. and belonged to every one and no one. And also, if you watch that video, you'll see that the people who fired the shots are young men. They're not old men from, so they're not men that he, you know, hung around with in his heyday. These are people who are very young men. You can see looking at them, the way they're dressed and everything. They're not in paramilitary uniform of any kind. Therefore, I would be inclined to think they don't belong to any paramilitary organization.
You're inclined to think they're people who are trying to recreate the sort of the farewell to a hero. Who
I would say it's probably been something that he has asked for, you know, at some point in time, and it's been left as instructions. So that's the way he'd be buried. And then he had a funeral that took place yesterday, which was Thursday, in St. Paul's on the Falls Road, which is the beautiful church just facing the Royal. There was a piper and a tricolour of the coffin, but no colour party and no other paramilitary chaplains at the funeral. Clearly that had all happened when the shots were fired the night before. And the tricolour has to be taken off the coffin before you can go into the church, and a white covering was put over the top of it instead. And his funeral, I listened to the homily, and that was a very different man than the one I'm describing to you. You know, at this point, it was the description of his children and people who clearly loved him as someone else compared to the sort of public figure. And they said that, you know, sadly, they said he had rescued cats in the street. He was an animal lover who liked to rescue stray cats. And that talked about how polite and well-mannered he was, and how he took his hat off coming into church and opened doors for people. And then the priest in his homily told a story that I thought, well, in fact, it's Easter week, that really helps you out here. But also I thought, my God, this man should work for political parties, you know, as a press officer, because he told the very famous story from the Bible about Jesus on the cross, and who is at each side of him? The two sinners, the two thieves. And what does he do? He tells one that tonight, because he seeks, you know, absolution for his sins, that tonight we will be in paradise together. And clearly you can see the inferences that the priest is making. So without making any reference to Hooker Moore in his past or who he was, he made a reference to the fact that even the sinner on the cross, you know, can make his way into heaven if he repents. So
the golden gates would have been left open for him, in other words.
I'm sure the inference was, I was sure at some point you'd have to repent. I don't know. I'm not a religious person. I don't know whether you can kill a whole lot of people and then repent and end up in heaven. That's for other people who actually care about those sort of things.
I find it extraordinary, apart from the details of his life, the fact that he was born, bred, and never left that Bombay Street.
Left in
a coffin, you know. And yet he had that life, you know, from that area, that fulcrum of that part of Belfast. He did all those atrocities, really, and was able to lurch from one violent grouping to the next, and in and out of prison, and all that life happened probably in the same house.
And the house that was burnt during those sort of loyalist incursion into Bombay Street, then they built other houses. The community came out and built those houses, and his family then moved back into the house, and that was the house he was still living in when he was found dead. So yeah, you know, one time when you come up, I must take a walk down Bombay Street, because when you see it, it's so small. There's a huge big peace wall, and then there's a memorial garden and everything in it. But it really is, I suppose, if you're talking about where modern conflict started and then also where the sort of the start of when the official IRA broke away into the provisional IRA, and what happened in terms of who was there, because there was no one there to come out and protect the people who lived in that area, and everything that happened, and then the army were sent, and all of this really stems from this one wee tiny area and street of Clonard. I lived very close to there in my very early days, because I bought a house there and it was really cheap. That was the one that had the big cage around it. and it's, you know, it's interesting when you see it, because people probably think, just like, you know, when they think about Bloody Sunday and what happened in Derry, you think it's this vast area that all this happened, and then you go and see it and you realise it's one road.
Yes.
You know, if you go to Clonard, you'll see how small Bombay Street is. So everyone would have known him in that street. Everyone would have known his family. Everyone would have known him. And I suppose that's maybe where he felt safe and where he felt comforted. Someone like him with a reputation like his couldn't live everywhere. And he still had friends who would have been, despite the fact he had a fallout with the IRA and with that mainstream Republican movement, and clearly was never someone who was interested in politics of Sinn Féin or anything like that. He clearly remained someone who had friends. Otherwise, he wouldn't have lived so happily and so quietly in that area. You know, he had friends in all sorts of different walks of life, and And also had some, I'm assuming, some pretty bad enemies. And but the
did
fact
he survive
was
okay. any assassination attempts, you know, of?
There's nobody was, I don't think there was anyone was ever mad enough to try and assassinate him. So right. I did hear one story, but I wasn't able to double source or back it up, that during one of the feuds that some young fellow was sent to kill him, and Hooker talked him out of it and says, "Nice son, you're not going to do that, are you? You wouldn't want to be killing the like of me." And the guy handed him the gun and walked off. And that was the end of that.
Well, I mean, very believable given much of you know, the history of him you've gone through. What did he die of?
He had to have a post-mortem, so therefore it would suggest, I did hear that he had maybe had a fall at home. A lot of people said he might have suffered a heart attack, but he didn't die of anything that was in any way suspicious or anything like that. He basically just died alone,
It kind of half scares me to do the maths and to realise that people are dying that were kind of young in the 1980s.
Shh, don't, because when I'm thinking about these things, when people talk about this as if it's history, like I remember, like, I mean, I was, 19 or whatever, and then at the, let's say 19, it was probably 19 on the night of Long Knives, and remembered all so well, and now I'm talking about it as if it's this far off historical event that happened away when the dead things were black and white, you know what I mean? And it's my youth, so yeah, it is quite terrifying, really. But I suppose it's also the natural progression of life and the circle of life that these people who held really, you know, high profile roles, who were responsible in many ways for the conflict that existed here, they're just dying. You know, it's just the natural progression of things. And so there's stories that maybe went untold and couldn't be told while they were still alive, can be told after their deaths. And that's, I suppose, just how it's the circle of life, isn't it?
It sure is. Well, look, he had one hell of an interesting life, if you'd call it that, and you know, it's great to be able to get the detail of that night of the Long Knives. I think that Putin had one of those at one point as well.
I think a lot of what happened here was, you'll find that a lot of the names for things that happened here were stolen from that sort of Soviet time as well, because people would have had a great interest in the politics of the communist politics of that area. So you can see also a lot of the political posters from that time, the replicas of the communist posters that would have been put out by like Stalin and stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, these stories just keep coming. You're dealing with stuff that's happening in the here and now, but I think particularly in the north, there's so much history. We need to catch up on so much that was hidden away, you know, and obviously it was just so, it was so busy with everything that was happening with the war and everything, that all these details.
And as a journalist, journalists who were reporting in that time, I mean, if I would have went back, I mean, I'm in work, there would have been a big archive room that had all these leather-bound copies of newspapers from the time, and you're covering, maybe somebody died and you thought, I'll go back and look and see that they had been someone who'd survived maybe a bomb attack or an IRA attack or a loyalist attack in the past, and you go back to look up to see what happened and there's nothing, or there's, you know, a tiny little sidebar on the side of the paper, you know, of explaining what happened and then nothing else, because so much was happening every day that the journalists were maybe covering four or five major stories that would be front page for a week in modern times,
literally lurching from one major story to the next constantly. And we've spoken about that before, about some of the kind of the murders, maybe some domestic type murders and stuff that were almost sort of forgotten, or they wouldn't have got the nowadays they will make front page news, they will be something we'll be talking about, but back then there was just so much going on that lots was lost and all that. So alright, thanks a million, Alison, see you next week.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from sundayworld.com, produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Chloe Domini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free sundayworld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.